Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Yes Sir HR. As usual, my name is Mark, and I am with...
Yes, you're still with me, Mark, here in Jersey.
In Jersey, and how's the weather in Jersey?
It's significantly better than last week. Last week was a kind of a reification of January the 2nd, cold and windy. It's maybe about 8-9 degrees now, and the wind has abated a bit, but it's still kind of jumper and coat territory if one does actually leave the house.
All right, okay, because it's absolutely sweltering in Singapore. No, it's not. It's absolutely terrible. Walking from the MRT to the office and you're literally drenched in perspiration.
Mate, when I was there, I could play 90 minutes of football in midfield, cover every blade of grass, and I still wasn't sweating.
That's crazy. That's absolutely crazy.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Okay.
There you go. different constitutions, and we will be touching on the brain and its chemical behaviours and how they work and what we might do to deal with them. But I'll let you introduce that a bit more.
Yep, exactly. So today I think we are going to do something slightly different. And I must say this is probably more up your alley. I do know some parts of it. But I think most of it is you, because I think you have done quite extensive research and reading on brain neurology. And I think today what we're going to attempt to do is we're going to try and talk a little bit about the implications of brain neurology on how we actually teach and what we need to take note of. So in order for us to do this, I think it would be good if we set the context a little bit for our listeners. And I think some of the things that we need to talk about is happy chemicals. So maybe you can start off with that. Then can you just take us through what exactly are happy chemicals and why are they important in the area that we're going to talk about?
The thing is that they're fundamental to our existence and well-being. Okay. We spend a lot of time talking about how we influence learning environments, the use of instructional strategies, and increasingly the impact of technology. And these are external factors to the body. So our job as educators is to create conditions in which people learn better and have better well-being. Would you go along with that basic existential premise?
Okay, I can accept that.
Yeah, but what we're impacting ultimately is the brain. I think it was Dick Schwab, title of one of his books that I did read thoroughly. And it's a great read. And he basically says we are our brains. In other words, everything that kind of happens goes on in the brain. And if, you know, we've been chatting a bit and it is now beginning to hit the news. I've even written a couple of articles in the local paper, and I'm quite proud of that because you're the techie man. And for me to be writing about neural networks and ChatGPT, it is quite good. It really is like the world media now. Can we take that as you think?
Okay, I would think so. I think it's still a bit early days yet. I mean, we do have some of the tech titans coming in and say we need to do a pause in AI. So yeah, but I would agree with that premise. Yeah.
Well, if you look at artificial intelligence, what's making it more powerful now than perhaps a few years back, or it's now being revealed, is that it's now modeling neural networks. And that's right. The idea of deep learning. It's not a superficial algorithm. In other words, like you press a button or you say one word, you know, some of these artificial intelligence toys, you know, you say, hello, what's your name? Oh, my name's Poppy, and how are you? You know, that kind of, that's a very simple type of programming. It's pretty easy to do, and that's been around for a long time. But this stuff is kind of almost morphing the natural architecture of the brain. And given the brain has about 86 billion neurons and they can connect to thousands of other neurons, it's a pretty tough goal, isn't it? So that's what's making the generative artificial intelligence. So that's an important thing, you know, for people to bear in mind. And that is that the IT system really does model the way humans actually interact. So that's what's made ChatGPT a very novel feature, apart from it being much more powerful in terms of its impact on learning and teaching. So let's get back to the brain. Now, what the brain, our brain does, is it responds to the environment in certain ways. And obviously it orientates the body. If you're crossing the road, hopefully our perceptual system sees the oncoming car or the red light or whatever it is. And those messages are quickly translated to the brain. And that then makes us not cross the road, hopefully, or at least take evasive action, right? But what we do know about the brain also is it affects our feelings. And this is massive. If you go back to, if I said to you, tell me something in your life that made you feel really good. Now, remember, we are on air. So give me a couple of examples when you think, wow, that was really, you know, a peak experience. That was a great experience, whatever.
Bungee jumping.
Are you sick? Were you a Manchester United supporter? Was that a kind of precursor to committing suicide at some stage?
No. I mean, I always wanted to do it. And then we were in New Zealand, and that's the only place, I have to be quite frank, that I would do bungee jumping, because I think the safety record is second to none. So that was something that I always wanted to do. And just so happened that I was in New Zealand and I decided to do it. And I must say that I didn't really think very much about it, because I thought to myself, the more I thought about it, the more likely I wasn't going to do it. So I just decided to stand there, and I told him, and if he says jump, and I'll just jump. And I did. It's one of the best things I ever did, I must say.
Okay, so you got a buzz out of it, right?
Of course, yeah.
Now, that's what we mean by chemicals in the brain, that things in the environment, things we do, things that people do to us, do affect the chemistry of the brain. And that basically means that certain chemicals can be released as we have certain experiences. So for you, I would say doing the bungee jumping, at one level, there's a sense of fear and a sense of challenge. Yeah. And by doing it and completing it and not ending up a kind of splat on the mountain floor, it probably kicked in a fair bit of endorphins. So that gives you that sort of feeling of wow, of euphoria. I've done it. And in a sense, it's almost like when we have a painful experience, that endorphins can kick in to mask the pain. And also when we meet a big challenge. So that's one of the happy chemicals. So even though we might find it painful, challenging, when we get there, it's, oh yes, it's like doing your exams, that when you finish that final exam, you think, wow, I put in a massive shift here. That can give you that endorphin kick. So that's one aspect. So give me something else that has made you feel good. I mean, that's one experience. What other things make you feel good? Apart from Tottenham losing or whatever, you know.
What about getting validation for your work, you know, doing it and then getting, you know, writing an abstract and then not sure if it would be accepted in a conference, and then finally getting it, and then you're getting your paper accepted. That's another example I can give you.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, teaching, we've had a conversation really before, but I think we won't name who said it, but it's been said that teaching is the second most private act. And this is the kind of thing sometimes that teachers work hard and they don't necessarily see the results. It could be a student a year later looking back and saying, wow, that teacher made a big difference. And it could be you. When we do get some recognition, even though we might not, I mean, some people seek it all the time. The narcissistic personality would be doing that. But most people like being recognized. I mean, we can talk about Stephen Covey, private victories before public victories, and I mean, that's true. I mean, that often works that way, but it is nice when I'm gonna embarrass badly I was actually your boss, and then later you became my boss. And we had awards, didn't we, about people who put, I think we had three awards. One was to do with being really nice, caring, concerned. Another one was always taking on challenges. And I remember you got one of those rewards. I think you owe me for that. I'm just joking. But no, you thoroughly deserved it. And I think kind of, you know, that communicated to you, even though you're quite an humble person, really, is that, you know, you feel good about the fact that your work is recognised and it ain't based on you going around telling people, oh, I've been on this meeting, I've done this. It was other people saying, Mark's a really, you know, good guy, he helps you out, he's always prepared to put an extra shift in. So that's another chemical, and that is called serotonin.
Yeah.
It's about a sense of pride, a feeling that you're respected. And, you know, when you get a genuine compliment, it does release those brains, those chemicals in the brain. And that's a kind of nice thing. And that's something that we may need to do more in society. So when we go on to talk about education, it certainly will have implications in school, how we can use the way we interact with students. Anyway, so that's one. Anything else that you would say to you is important in your life? It might not be an everyday wow factor, like an endorphin kicking in, but
I think the day-to-day stuff would be the social networks, working with people, working with new lecturers, and then, of course, seeing your friends, even you being a Spurs fan, you know, talking about football, building social networks and all. Yeah, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, these are everyday things, and we don't, when you see your friend or you see a member of your family that you like, we don't necessarily like all our family members. I don't have that worry because most of mine are dead. So if I meet up with them, I don't know whether that would be a dopamine rush or an endorphin rush or whatever. But I mean, apart from my immediate family, but me, you know, parents, and I've no brothers and sisters or aunts or uncles or anything like that. But yeah, that kind of thing is... I mean, that's the other chemical. I mean, there's four main ones. We've mentioned endorphins and we've mentioned serotonin. It's called oxytocin. It's less mentioned, you know, in the lay literature, but it's very important that kind of nice feeling of, I mean, for example, over the weekend, I did go and see my two daughters and their partners, and it was really nice to see them. I was sort of jumping up and down with massive excitement because I've seen quite a bit of them recently because I'm back in the UK. But that nice feeling you get when they're pleased to see you and you go out and have a meal and you watch a bit of football together and whatever. So that's something that's important. And for people that perhaps are not members of groups, are quite lonely, I mean, loneliness to some extent, you know, is certainly a lack of oxytocin, as it is other things. And yeah, we benefit from that kind of chemical being released in their brain.
Right.
Okay. One more, and that's the big one that often we talk about, and that's dopamine. So, right. This is that real sort of wow thing of that we've achieved something. It's super pleasurable. Watching Tottenham beat Manchester United in the European Cup final would be a dopamine rush. Winning the lottery, you know, with a few million would be a dopamine rush for me. I don't think... Elena Rybakina, and the tennis player, is going to ring me up and say, would you like to come out for dinner? That would be a rush as well. I'm just sort of spinning examples out here. So what are dopamine rushes for you?
Okay. I would think that a dopamine rush for me would be, playing football at one stage. But I think right now it's really just, to be honest, just really... having a nice juicy steak is enough to send dopamine vibes up my brain, actually.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, one of the things that was a good dopamine rush for me in Singapore, and
yeah, chili crab.
It was more than that. If you remember the buffets, which I think they still have, where you pay a certain amount, it could be $90, and some of them more than $100, and you can eat as much as you like on anything. It could be lobsters and crab, and it was unlimited. And again, to go to one of those was always a real dopamine hit for me.
Right. Okay.
So that's our four happy chemicals that are more or less agreed in by people in the field. So in the sense that these chemicals, when released, can make us feel better. And if we don't get opportunities for any of them to be released, then we are possibly in an unhealthy, maybe even depressed state in the longer run if we don't get any of these.
Okay. So let me just do a quick summary and then you let me know if I got it right. So essentially, when we talk about happy chemicals, there are four kinds. There's dopamine, endorphin, serotonin, and oxytocin. So dopamines really are tied up with motivation and what one derives pleasure from. And it could be a nice little steak. It could be watching your favorite team win the World Cup or something like that. Is that correct?
Dopamine? Yeah.
Okay. So for endorphin, it's really about results from dealing with pain and challenge. For example, when you said you tried to cover every blade of grass and your muscles are screaming in pain, but you still find pleasure in doing it, that's endorphins, correct?
Yeah, very much so for me.
Okay. So serotonin is really about getting a compliment, you know, somebody acknowledging your work that you have done. And you may be possibly winning a prize based on your work that you have done, that would be serotonin, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, and oxytocin, of course, will be mostly on socialization, working with people with the same mindset, doing things with your close friends, that's oxytocin.
Yeah, I mean, coming back to Singapore only sort of 6 or 7 weeks ago, meeting up with you and the research team and those guys, yeah. I mean, that was very much oxytocin. But also, because I haven't seen you for a couple of years, it was also dopamine. So it was really a good, good, in a sense, release of more than one of those. So if we are releasing all of those happy chemicals in one go, that really is a peak experience, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think nothing beats meeting face-to-face, even though we practically do this every week online. But I think it's a whole new experience when you see someone and then you can speak to that someone without actually a phone in front of your face. But, you know, speaking one-on-one, I think certainly brings, I would suppose, a happy chemical reaction in that sense. But more importantly, I just want to shift the conversation a little bit. So if we have these happy chemicals, what are some implications that we have that teachers will need to know on how they would need to balance this in their classrooms? So maybe what you can do now is, can you set the context for us as a novice teacher or someone who's just learning about neuroscience and the neural networks of the brain and the happy chemicals? What do we need to take note of? And let's do this maybe one at a time, but for you to set the general tone before we dive into the teaching and learning aspects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's important to see things within the wider context. For example, talk about the impact of artificial intelligence, right?
Yeah.
It's going to impact education massively.
Okay.
But it's going to impact all of society massively.
Okay.
And the benefits could be very positive or they could be very negative, right?
Yep.
So there's an interaction between, if you like, the wider social milieu and what goes on in educational institutions and what goes on in individual brains, right? You know, there's always that kind of dialectic between those three things. And I think why we were thinking about doing this topic is that the work of two people in particular that I'm familiar with. One is Anna Lemke and the other one is Loretta Bruning. Loretta, I've had some contact with her and she did, I think, say that she'd happily do a podcast at some stage. We've got to get the timing right between Singapore and California, I think she is. Certainly America and here. What takes up, but I think Loretta would be happy to do that.
Right.
And the basic thesis from Anna Lemke is a social analysis, and what she has noted, and others would have done so also, that in the richest countries, of which the UK, America, these Western countries, and others, of course, those that seem to have people where they don't have to worry about whether they're going to get food to eat, that there's many material things and entertainment activities, very much a kind of sort of Western thing, that people seem to be more miserable than ever, according to her. And she looks at various metrics for that. Rates of anxiety, depression are going up, and also suicide going up in many studies, though it can vary from social groupings. I think one of the things in the UK that's a bit worrying, Jordan Peterson mentions it, I think he's talking about the West, is that basically young male suicides are, you know, are one of those areas where it's very, very high. And yeah. What Lemke does, she connects the way society is in terms of there's plenty of, if you like, dopamine possibilities. We're constantly bombarded on the media. I'll do this, buy this, add this. And the idea is that it's going to be pleasurable. But the problem is that the brain has a kind of homeostasis between pain and pleasure. So if you keep activating the pleasure thing, so you have a bit of a dopamine rush, you have a bit more of a dopamine rush, you're chasing more, that when these things stop it being impactful, and they do, and this is the big problem, isn't it, with yeah. pleasure, that
the Singapore buffets,
but imagine every day doing that, there'd be no dopamine rush, just simply be how much can I eat and how much weight am I going to put on here.
Yeah.
So the basic thing that she's saying is that as we're chasing more and more pleasure, we're habituating to the things, and when they no longer have such an high impact in terms of making us feel good, the pendulum swings the other way, the pain factor comes into play. And it's a bit like people who are addicted. They have their heroin hit and they feel good, and then the down is bad. And then they need more heroin and more heroin and more heroin to try to get anywhere. So that's the real nemesis, the shadow, if you like, of having too many pleasurable things too often, in a sense that ultimately they don't have the impact. It was like the research, I think we mentioned it with the monkeys. We could, I mean, I just spin it through again because I think it's kind of relevant. The experiment yeah. with monkeys, where monkeys were typically used to eating leaves, and they measured the dopamine levels with monkeys, and they got a kind of baseline. Then they gave the monkeys fruit, and their dopamine went up massively. But after a few days, it went back to a kind of much lower level. And they thought, oh, okay, whatever. We'll put the monkeys back on the leaves. And what happened when the monkeys were given the leaves? They actually reacted very angrily, and they were throwing the leaves at the experimenters. So the danger is that at the end of the day, they got used to the fruit. So what else do you give them? Do you then give them fruit with a dose of morphine or whatever? I mean, where does that go to? So there is a danger in trying to find too many pleasures too quickly. And that's the basic thesis. And that's certainly consistent with my kind of experience, at the individual level, and looking at how I see people, in societies where I see people who are very wealthy and got comfortable lives, they'll find things to moan around about. I mean, I remember in Singapore seeing some wealthy families moaning about having their domestic helpers moving a picture. Oh, it's so stressful. In the end, that kind of there's hardly anything that gives pleasure, and almost anything can start becoming a stressor. And that's the issue with it, is that stress levels are increasing because of there's too many so-called pleasurable things, that people are not content with the everyday things. So that's the thesis. So anything you want to add to that?
Yeah.
And then we can look at it in relation to educational implications.
Okay, so I'm going to stretch it a little bit from what you are saying, and this is my interpretation. So too much of a good thing, obviously, is bad. So that's the first thing. So you mentioned this idea about homeostasis, right?
Homeostasis, yeah.
Homeostasis, okay.
Yeah.
Maybe can you just elaborate a little bit more on that, and then I'll give you my take on this. So what exactly does that mean? Yeah.
The basic idea is the body tries to keep some kind of balance. You know, it's like if you do too much exercise, you can feel absolutely exhausted. And if you don't do anything, you can actually feel kind of bored and lethargic. So there's a kind of balancing factor. You know, like when you set the eating, it can go off at a certain time. If it gets too hot, it will bring it back to a certain level. And if it gets too cold, it will bring it up to a certain level. So that concept of our brains trying to keep our body in a kind of fairly stable mood. It's like with top sportsmen. If you look at sort of tennis players who choke on the big points, the anxiety has gone off the rails. They can't actually control it. It seems to be that the tennis players who are on the big points can keep that balance of knowing it's important, knowing that they've got to be at their best and not worrying about, you know, the implications of missing it. So the brain seeks this kind of balancing. If you had too much pleasure all the time, you'd probably die of a heart attack because it would be so euphoric. Equally, right, you're so low all the depression and, you know, potentially suicidal, I guess.
Right. So here's the irony, right? That while we have this, and we look at the happiness index, more people are more miserable more than ever. How do you reconcile that? Yeah.
Well, it's because that the constant seeking of more and more things. Oh, if we get the new gadget, or we get the new iPhone, or we get this app, and we get this, we're going to feel better. And then we keep chasing these things, and in the end, there's virtually no more dopamine rush. So whereas the child maybe who's quite poor, living in a underdeveloped country, but got enough food and got nice families. So a bar of chocolate, it's a big dopamine rush. And I remember it's a story, I think it's a relevant story. Many years back, myself and friend and father-in-law, we went, and one of the staff who used to be there, Alan Jolliffe, we went to Cambodia and we took stuff to an orphanage.
Yeah.
When we were there, we organised some games. We took over lots of clothes and various things. And what was really interesting is Alan had gone over previously with other staff and given them radios for their rooms and things.
They came
running out with the radios and not working, you know, really upset. And Alan gave them all a battery each, and suddenly it started working. And the look on their faces was pure, massive dopamine, simply because they could now listen to the radio. Right. I've seen kids in Singapore who not Singaporeans, but it could apply to them as well, because they're so wealthy, having to travel business class, they've actually cried, "Oh, I've had to travel business class. I usually travel first class." And they're actually in a kind of really fed up, you know, anxious, stressed, because they're having to travel in.
Because they used to
first class. So go back to the Cambodia thing. At the end of the day, we gave each kid a bag with, I think it was a chocolate bar, there was an orange and a can of Coke and a couple of other little things. They all got the same thing. And they were so, so happy to receive that. So for these people, their baseline is that, oh, if my family are okay and I've got enough to eat, I'm reasonably happy. So suddenly I'll get a treat. Wow, that's a big rush. Yeah. Whereas people who can almost have everything, and it's like nothing is giving them a rush. And that's the real problem, I think. Well, I think that makes perfect sense to me from my experience. So that would be the scenario, okay, you know, with examples.
So can I? So is this too much of a stretch if I say, and I'm trying to translate this into a classroom practice, and you tell me whether this makes sense or whether it's totally off. So sometimes, you know, in classrooms where we play games with students and we reward them, so that could create a kind of dopamine rush. If we do this too often, and one day we decide we're not going to provide a prize, that creates the drop, and then we have a problem. And then we become unhappy. Would that be a fair statement to make?
That absolutely. If you, I mean, when we talk about motivation in the classroom, we can talk about intrinsic motivation. Correct. But also, the mistake that a lot of people have is, oh well, extrinsic motivation is bad and intrinsic motivation is good. I mean, in a sense, these two things are important and intertwined. For example, chocolate is a great motivator. If you go into a classroom with, you know, with obviously the kids have got to like chocolate, and if they are come from super wealthy families, you know, the chocolate you give them may be significant. Yeah, if it's not kind of sort of some expensive chocolate, it might not work as well. But in mainstream schools, if you go in and occasionally you say to students, well, if you can do these assignments and get this done and work collectively as a team, everybody gets a chocolate, whatever, that will be a motivator. But you couldn't do that for every lesson, every day, for two reasons. One is it would lose its dopamine. It'd be like the, you know, the chimpanzees, hold on a minute, you know, kind of, it's not another chocolate almond or whatever.
Yeah.
So the idea is that you use these things kind of thoughtfully. You might say, right, maybe once a week for each class, you will have an activity and you'll use that. And it will get the dopamine rush and it will have a motivational factor. And also, as teachers, we don't earn enough to give every class chocolates to all kids. So, yeah, I mean, so it's about identifying what are motivational aspects, whether that it's extrinsic, and what we can do intrinsically that might be more enduring. Okay.
So I think that's important because, and I'm glad you brought that up, that both extrinsic and intrinsic motivation is intertwined. I think there's too much misconception, in my opinion, of people who think, oh, extrinsic motivation is bad and we need to try and do intrinsic motivation, without realizing that you probably would need to engage in some form of extrinsic motivation to get to intrinsic motivation.
Absolutely. I mean, these studies that say, I mean, that it's a very naive thing. I mean, if you never think about attribution theory in different ways, that when you ask people, are you motivated by money at work? The reality of it is that they're not going to say yes. Oh no, it's more important that a member of a team. And yeah, I mean, that is the end of the day. My observation, and both in working class communities, in middle class communities across the world, is that people are motivated by money and status. It's just that it's not socially acceptable to say that. So even when they fill in these questionnaires and people say they're motivated by this and this and that, I wouldn't give too much credence to that idea that extrinsic motivational factors are not as important. And it would vary from person to person and context. Obviously, somebody with plenty of money, then the salary is not such a big thing. The intrinsic motivators come into play. That's the only thing, in the sense that kind of made any sense in Maslow's model, that certainly if you haven't got enough food to eat and you've got nowhere, you've got no shelter, your mind is going to be taken up with that. Once you then go beyond that kind of physical level, then the model, in my opinion, and the evidence would suggest that the model breaks down somewhat. Anyway, that's my frame on that.
Okay, got it. So let's now go and drill a little bit deeper into the area of teaching and learning. And I think what we want to talk about is some of the implications that the brain chemicals have and their impact on teaching and well-being. So I think the first thing that we need to really talk about is boredom. I think this may really look, and maybe what we can do is let's try and unpack that a little bit. Nowadays, with so many technology available and with games literally at their fingertips, and with ChatGPT helping to help students with their homework, students obviously now come to classes being bored very easily. So what kind of role does the happy chemicals play in this instance?
Well, we really are, you know, it's hitting a bit of a brick wall here, because, I mean, research, I think it was Tony Wagner in the Achievement Gap, talking to students across the world and talking to students on advanced courses. So we're not talking about the kids who perhaps have very little interest in school, saying that, you know, lots of school stuff is boring. So, you know, given that, and now given that there's things like ChatGPT, to, you know, to one, do the research, do their own work, coming into class, watching teachers show PowerPoint slides, and particularly if they've got a monotone voice, so it really is a, this really is educational Jurassic Park of the Tyrannosaurus kind of genre, isn't it? Yeah. So there's a real storm here. So the you know, if we look at schools now, if students can learn better, perhaps use sitting at home or listening to music with ChatGPT at 4 and maybe 5, and there's also talk of another one coming out called AutoGPT. I was just looking at a video on YouTube on that. So how are we going to get them to be terribly interested in, you know, metaphors and similes in the plot of Romeo and Juliet, you know, for kids who are 12 and 13 years of age? Okay, those who want to do GCSE literature and are interested in that, fine. So there's a real massive challenge now to look at our curriculum and say, how can we make this curriculum in more brain compatible? In other words, so students are learning things that they can see some purpose and meaning in. So if you look at the teaching of English, for example, I think that, you know, once you start talking about GCSEs, it's more specialised, etc. But up to that level, it's got to be about getting students to find interesting things, to read things that they're interested in. Let's be honest about it. Students are interested in things. They might not be part of the school curriculum. So as long as they're interested in reading stuff and you get them to develop reading skills, that's great. Let them write about the things they're interested in, because that's more motivating. It kicks in some of these chemicals in some ways. And you can build a vocabulary and a grammar into that and get them to talk about it, so you develop the those kind of skills. So there's got to be a radical reframing of a lot of the school curriculum, that a lot of what's being taught now is just not going to be useful. It's not going to be useful for students, and it's going to be painful for teachers who are going into classrooms and trying to make this stuff meaningful when it clearly isn't.
Yeah, okay. What about teachers then? So we have looked at the students coming to be bored. What about teachers then? How do these happy chemicals impact their the way they do their work?
Well, I mean, look at the TES report last year. It was a TES union report looking at teachers. It's got the highest attrition rate of, I think, any occupational group in the UK, levels of stress, et cetera, et cetera. I think 75% of teachers talking about leaving in the next 2 years. They're not happy. They're not happy bunnies, are they, in the main? I mean, we're generalising. Of course, a lot of them will be. It would depend on personality type, institution, leadership. You know, all the things that are, variation across institutions, etc., etc. But certainly there are lots of things that seem to be stressful for many teachers. And at the end of the day, those happy chemicals are not coming out as much as perhaps they used to, because of other things that are sort of more painful in the environment, or there's not enough opportunity for them to feel that nice sense of elation. Obviously, one of the big things that I found in teaching and still do is when you see students learning and kind of progressing and sort of developing, that's a really good release of chemicals, isn't it? You know, of all those chemicals to some extent, if you think about it. If the students are bored, you're having to do so much extra admin work, and it's almost like a kind of Herzberg theory. I mean, the hygiene factors and motivational factors. There's a lot more hygiene factors than motivational factors, and therefore the brain chemicals, the happy chemicals, are less and less, if you like.
Yeah, okay. So for all those teachers and instructors listening to this, that's something for you to take note of. It's not all doom and gloom, but I think maybe now what we can do is we can just talk a little bit about areas that we can explore, knowing what we know. I think we've just begun to scratch the surface of what the power of the neural networks of our brains and so forth. But let's focus a little bit more on what are some of the things that teachers can do. So, and areas that they can explore a little bit. So I think one of the things that, and I think you have suggested this in previous episodes before, but let's explore this a little bit more. When you talk about explicitly teaching on how the brain works and what creates problems, as in you made reference to Lemke's analysis, can you elaborate a little bit more on that? What does that mean when you say teach explicitly on how the brain works, and why does this matter for teaching and learning?
Well, I think it's absolutely essential now that students from certainly secondary level, because once students get to sort of around about 12, they're capable of what Piaget referred to as formal operations. In other words, they can actually use the types of thinking, analysis, compare and contrast, inference, interpretation, and evaluation. They can actually think in abstract terms, right? Metacognition is there, but not at the level that it would be for an adult. We know that the prefrontal cortex don't fully develop to at least about 23, 24 years of age. And that's why adolescents, even though students can learn abstract things and actually think well, it's often short-circuited by the limbic system and the emotions and all those kind of chemicals that are kind of not getting them to self-regulate as well as they theoretically could do, right? So let's put that in context. The thing that students should be learning is how the brain and mind works. That should be a school subject. They should learn about these chemicals, and they should learn that these chemicals can have positive things, and that they're things that you seek to do. But yeah, the dangers of habituation, and how do you manage yourself? So teaching students how the brain works and how the mind works, and then teaching metacognition, which I think has got to be so centrally embedded in the curriculum, that has got to be a priori as a subject area and embedded across subjects. So students realize that, look, there are so many things out there that are enticing us, but if we're just chasing the dopamine rushes from them, we're going to have problems. So we've got to self-regulate. We've got to be able to say, right, we can't. Those understandings, and they've got to be part of the core values that are transmitted in educational circles, and to get them to recognize that the more sustainable chemicals, the ones from being part
ones,
these are things that are more enduring and
those kind of things.
So they're big areas as far as I'm concerned in terms of the school curriculum. Students must understand how they're working, because I think that's why so many of them have got mental health issues, because they're feeling anxiety, they're feeling stress, they don't know what it is, they're confused, and they end up possibly being labelled with, you know, this, that and the other. And the solutions are not with more labelling. The solutions are with a better.
It's almost
an existential thing to say to students, look, as human beings, you're going to be challenged all the time in different ways throughout your life. You know, suffering it's not just something that people had in concentration camps, you know, in the Second World War, but we all have that in our lives when things go wrong and relationships break up and perhaps you don't get the job you want and you're finding the studying hard and someone you'd like to be friendly with you doesn't want to be friendly with you. That these are existential things that you have to learn to deal with. It's not someone, mummy will fix it, or it's I'm entitled to this. That is
nemesis.
Unfortunate life
really like that.
And if you get go wrong there, focuses more on the reality of the human condition and how we can manage these things. Fundamental change in the focus of education. And given that we don't have to teach so much more content now with the technologies, this is where has to be better thinking, better self-regulation, better self awareness, those kind of things. And let the IT do a lot of the legwork. That doesn't mean we still must engage our brains because we must understand the subject, not just get GPT to come up with answers. But certainly we don't need to. We could make the old educational scene a lot more effective, efficient and interesting, I think. So there are a lot of positives that we can pull out of, you know, our knowledge of the brain and the mind and using the technology. So there are very positive potential outcomes. However, if the policy's not there and the wrong things happen, we just make a bigger hubris of the whole situation, you know, of kind of, oh, we're going to do this, everybody's going to be happy, we're all going to be entitled, and everybody's going to have their needs met. Ain't like that, is it? I mean, not as I see it, anyway.
Okay, so thanks for sharing that. Some other things that we can look at is really going back to the topic that we talked about in the last podcast with Ochin. And that is, make the curriculum more concept-based rather than topics. And I think she mentioned that as quite important because application or concept-based really gets students to deal very deeply with the subject and getting them to understand it at a more fundamental level rather than just teaching them topics, which tends to result in a lot more memory-based kind of options in that sense. So, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, see, when we use the word memory, that you know, people think memory instead of rote memorization. Memory, thing that we want, but we want, as Daniel Willingham said, memory is what's left after thinking. We want students to engage with all this content now, thoughtfully, so that what's in their memory are those key concepts that form the structure of understanding. That's the crucial thing, and that's why teaching the concepts is fundamental, because all the content can be accessed easily. So if they understand the teaching, focusing on key concepts helps the brain then be able to organize and make sense of these massive areas of content without memorizing them at a level of rote memorization. Because rote memorization, unless it is connected to the conceptual understanding, is not going to be useful. So massive area to look at the subjects that students are learning in school. What are the key concepts in those subjects? That's where the focus is. Absolutely. And I think the last thing that I would throw in is how we can make the way we teach our communication style such that students like being with each other. Well, not necessarily all the students, but like being with us. And that, you know, that keeps the
oxytocin
going. I think that's enduring, and that's where, you know, we talked about it in a podcast, an autonomy supportive style of teaching where students do have more choice, where the students see you, as I think John Marshall Reeve said, as their ally, not as the teacher in there trying to catch him out, look, tell them off. You have to have discipline in schools, and that's another issue. But I think you can have discipline in schools without having canes and shouting. But students have got to learn to be accountable. And if they can't participate, then they need to know that it's not acceptable for them to be disruptive and have a choice. They participate and take responsibility, or they have to take time out in some way, because there's got to be a radical shift towards more responsibility, better understanding of reality and better self-regulation. And a better value system where that we try to add more respect and graciousness. I mean, a couple of the values that you had in Singapore, and not this obsession with language and kind of, if we change language and we change all the history books and we make it degenderized and de-racialist, that this is going to improve things. In fact, it's likely to have very much the opposite effect. And I think the research is beginning to show that let's just get on and focus on key moral concepts, and the rest will tend to sort itself out. There's always going to be people that are racist in some way or whatever. I mean, that's just how it is, and those people are not going to be changed by, you know, changing little linguistic things. It's about having experiences that challenge, create cognitive dissonance. For example, I've been lucky enough to, and you have as well, we've traveled to so many different countries that you don't even think in racial or ethnic terms. There are people that you like, and there's always people that, for whatever reason, are not terribly nicely wired, and you know, you don't get on with and avoid.
Yeah, Okay. So I think that's a nice spot to stop because the oxytocin's running through my mind at the moment. And as always, we will leave some of the... I think Dennis has recommended a video on YouTube about some of the happy chemicals. And I will leave the link there so that you can actually watch the video to get a better understanding of the happy chemicals that we have talked about. So I think that's a perfect segment, in my opinion, something to think about that I would say that goes beyond the normal teaching and learning stuff that we are used to, and looking at studying the brain in a more deeper manner, and how we can make use of some of these happy chemicals to help us with our teaching and learning. So I hope you enjoyed that segment. I did something different. Maybe we need to explore other topics from a different angle. In the next few podcasts. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, ultimately, when we talk about designing instructional strategies, it's to make learning more effective, efficient, and hopefully more engaging, right? So if we can, if our instructional strategies can tap on and use these chemicals in thoughtful ways, not trying to release them all the time, but to, it's another part of thoughtful instructional design.
Right. Okay. Perfect. So that ends first segment. And as usual, we'll move on to my favorite segment of the podcast, where we talk a little bit about something that we may have read, something that we may have watched, or something that may have happened to us that we would like to share to our audience. So you want to go first then?
Yeah. I mean, I've spent... I spent the last week looking at AI and the kind of responses by credible people in the field of artificial intelligence on where it's going and what the impact's going to be on education. And I'm now kind of getting the notion that there's a lot of competition coming in terms of these chat boxes. And for me, keeping abreast of these and looking at how they can ultimately be combined to create the best use of artificial intelligence and be prepared for the changes that are going to start coming into play. So basically, for me, just doing more and more research in artificial intelligence and what the capability of these tools are, because we will need to understand that well if we're going to be at the forefront of professional development for teachers, because a lot of them are not going to be able to see the wood from the trees because they're too busy trying to deal with the realities of everyday classroom life.
Right. Okay. So I found something that you might be interested in. It is something that I came across on social media. Somebody was sharing this. It's something to do with ChatGPT. And the premise is, while people are starting to explore ChatGPT, not everyone is able to extract the full potential of ChatGPT because they aren't able to write very good prompts. And we all know that with ChatGPT, if you don't write good prompts, you get very generic answers that don't really help you. So... I was watching this social media channel and he's recommended a Google plugin, which means all you need to do is just go to Google and search for it and you can actually download it. And it's free. It's called AIPRM. And what that does is when you download it, it basically becomes part of your Google browser. And every time you call up ChatGPT, it can actually help you create prompts so that you can actually get the stuff that you really need without having to be frustrated and trying to figure out what could be the prompts that you would need to feed into ChatGPT. So I just came across it really honestly as we are recording this, so I haven't had a chance to explore it. But what I want to do is I will post the link and the video on AIPRM and how you can download it into your Google browser so that you can explore it and then you can extract the full potential of ChatGPT. How does that sound?
Yeah, that sounds great, because it is this question of, with all of these apps flying around now that can connect to these artificial, you know, to chat, GPT, they're all kind of plugins and potential and answers. So the big challenge is, how do we get the best integrated use of, you know, these technologies? So it's all part of EdTech now. It just adds another massive set of tools and a real dimension, I think, that is quite revolutionary. When we talked about online learning being a revolution in education some 40 years ago, I knew that that was a fallacy. It wasn't the best thing since sliced bread. It's now becoming potentially the next thing, since the next best thing since sliced bread, but it could be burnt toast if we make a mess of it. So that's, I think I'll leave on that polemic kind of note.
Okay, perfect. So that ends today's episode of Yes Sir, HR. If I'm not wrong, I think we're on the 62nd episode. As usual, if you would like to write to us, you can do so at evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. Once again, it is evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. So, yeah, we are done for this episode. What's the plan for the rest of the week then?
I've got a couple of articles to write for local newspaper and other things. So, yeah, pretty busy. But it keeps a little bit of dopamine firing out and a bit of oxytocin and a bit of serotonin. If people say, I like that. So I'm ticking along on some happy chemicals and still dealing with the fact that the I could be in Singapore with a nice 35 degrees and but it's something. So the thing is, I can look forward to my next trip, can't I? If I was coming over every week, I'd get bored. What, not another buffet owl, not more chili crab, not another Baron's beer. So it's quite good to have enough of things going on in everyday life that gives you a bit of meaning and fires a bit of happy chemicals, and then have a good couple of dopamine rushes, you know, over the course of the months and years, I guess, something like that.
Okay, perfect. So we'll see you next week. So take care, everyone, and goodbye.
And goodbye from me.